This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Computers in the classroom, our topic in this portion of the program. Are computers a useful tool? Are they being used effectively? Listeners, I welcome your questions this afternoon for Larry Cuban. He is a professor emeritus at Stanford University and a visiting professor of education at Teachers College Columbia. Larry Cuban is skeptical about the value of computerizing classrooms. He's studied the use of computers in several preschool and kindergarten classes, high schools, and at Stanford University, all in Silicon Valley. He found that many teachers had not successfully integrated the computer into the classroom. Larry Cuban is the author of the new book, Oversold and Underused, Computers in the Classroom. The book is published by Harvard University Press. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana. The number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Larry Cuban, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you. One of the very interesting things you say very early in the book involves the effort to prepare kids for the global economy, the workplace of the future. And you question that objective. Is that what school is for? Let's begin there. Would you share your thoughts on that issue with us?
Well, basically, schools have had many purposes since the introduction of tax-supported public schools in the middle of the 19th century. The primary goal has been to build citizens, literate citizens who are civic-minded, who are morally responsible, and who can go on and exercise their adult responsibilities. That's been the primary goal. For decades, around the turn of the last century, and certainly today, there has been an effort to make schools much more aimed at the preparation for workers. At the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, it was for manufacturing. Today, it's for the information-based workplace. A number of the points that I make in the book raise questions about that being the an appropriate primary goal when the historic goal has been civic literacy and building citizens. The larger issue is that one of the reasons for technology is to prepare young people so that they're going to be familiar with the information-based workplace. And the point that I make in the book, given what the research that I've looked at and also the research that I've done, is that the schools do very little to prepare people for the information-based workplace other than general literacy.
Hmm. Now, computer literacy is something that we hear a lot about. What is computer literacy, and is it a worthwhile objective?
Well, those are good questions. Computer literacy is like a glob of mercury. It just keeps bouncing around, and you never can put your finger on it and grab it. Computer literacy, when the personal computer became available in the early 1980s, computer literacy was learning the language called BASIC. Well, very few people even know the language BASIC now because it's gone. It mm-hmm. disappeared, largely disappeared. And so computer literacy gets continually redefined. So many people think that computer literacy is simply taking a course or two courses in middle school and high school. Other people think computer literacy is being able to program, to do HTML. Other people have a view of computer literacy as being able to troubleshoot all of the glitches that occur in a piece of software or a machine. So it really varies who you talk to in terms of the definition of computer literacy.
Mm. For most of us, my guess is that to be able to get onto the computer and use it for what we need it for, that's computer literacy.
I think that's reasonable. I don't think that a lot of people who are enthusiasts for computers would agree with you, because what you're just talking about is basically, oh, I would guess, 4 hours of learning, 8 hours tops. And you don't need to go to school to do that. You don't need keyboard courses to do that to last 36 weeks. So, again, it only shows the point that I'm trying to make, Celeste, that there is great variation mm-hmm. around this phrase, computer literacy.
Yeah. Well, it changes, too, from
yes, it does.
Almost day to day. I mean, one day I might not need to know how to perform a task, and the next day I do need to know that.
So. I would agree with you.
So let's go back to this idea of the function of schools. The function of school, it prepares us for life as adults. It builds us into, hopefully, you know, good citizens so that we can play a role in shaping our community and national life. But part of that life also is being able to earn a living.
Right.
And this is something that makes parents real jittery. They want to make sure that their kids will come out of school with the skills they need to make a good living.
I agree. There's always been tension between these multiple purposes for public schooling and actual private schooling too. So you've already stated that that when I talk about building citizens, we've talked about the importance of preparing people for productive labor, and now you mention, in this case, personal financial success, which is what parents want. And all of those have competed against one another as purposes in the history of our country. Right now, we are in a period, and have been for the last two decades, when people say that the purposes of public school is to prepare people for productive labor. And that has been the primary purpose. Well, that fits a lot of parents in terms of their needs for their individual sons and daughters. The issue that I would point out is basically that what parents are really concerned about is not so much the they want the literacy, but what they're concerned about is a credential, a high school diploma, a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Science degree, a master's degree, a PhD, all of those credentials are what employers really look at. They do not look at what grades you earned in the courses in each of those levels of education. So it's the credential that's associated with lifetime earnings, for example. And so that is extremely important, but it doesn't mean that the education that is the teaching and learning that goes on in the schools produces that money. It's the credential that produces the money. Follow?
Yeah, but how was it that the credential got linked to computer technology?
Because computer technology is not necessarily linked to the credential. What happened is in the early 80s, there was a report called The Nation at Risk, which was written by a number of corporate and civic leaders that basically lambasted the public schools for helping to lower the productivity of the American economy. And as a consequence, America was a non-competitor in the global economy, and the schools had to turn around to be more productive. Part of that was that computers and the use of computers could make teaching and learning more efficient, more effective. There would be more teaching, more learning, and it would be better. And also, at the same time, the computers could then be drafted to help students then become skilled for the workplace. So that kind of merger, that kind of convergence occurred roughly in the early to mid-80s.
Okay, so that's how we got ourselves into this oversold position?
And let me just take a moment, Celeste, to make the point about oversold. There is a theory, a logic that's behind all the vendors and the corporate leaders and the civic officials and the educators who want more software, more computers in schools. And that logic goes like this. If everyone had access to these machines and software, then they would be used more than they would be used. And if they are used, then the goals of having more efficient learning, more efficient teaching, of transforming teaching from a kind of teacher-centered, dominated kind of classroom to more of a student-centered kind of classroom, and then equipping future workers with important skills, those purposes would then be fulfilled. They would be achieved. So that logic of increasing access while increasing the use will lead to achievement of the purposes. That logic is what's driving the enormous expenditures for wiring schools, for purchasing machines, and buying the software. And what I have found in my book in Northern California, where the attitudes are very positive toward computer technology, is that that was not the case at all.
Hmm. Yeah, you went to schools in Silicon Valley.
Yes.
The assumption being if technology is being used and used effectively, that would be the place.
That would be the place. The attitudes are most positive. The naysayers are supposedly not willing to voice their negativity at all. And what I found was really surprising for me. I found that most teachers and most students already had computers, that they used it at the machines at home much more than they used it in school for instruction, and that there were no technophobes. You couldn't blame teachers for not using it in school. Everyone really wanted to use these computers, but they weren't used in school very much.
And why not?
Well, there are a number of reasons, but let me just lay out some of the data that I found that corresponds with national data, too. I found that at all levels, no more than one or two teachers at all levels were serious users. And a serious user is someone who uses the machines for instruction maybe once a week. And then there were about three or four teachers who were occasional users at all levels. And these are people who would use it once a month. And then the rest were non-users. And that's within an environment in which there is enormous access to these machines. And when I say non-users, I'm again referring to using the technology for instruction in classrooms. So that, all of that surprised me a great deal.
Now, some classrooms were using, as you mentioned, a few classrooms were using computers quite effectively in the
yes.
classroom. And I believe the classroom of Esperanza Rodriguez,
the preschool classroom,
classroom, and the classroom of Mark Hunter at George Elementary School,
right?
These folks were using computers very effectively. Tell us about them and how they were using computers in their classrooms.
We found about 5% of all the teachers we observed and actually shadowed in schools, about 5% were very active users. They were serious users, used it at least once a week, and they integrated the use of the computers into their daily routines so that if there was a unit, there was a high school teacher that we profiled in the book who wanted to have her students learn about utopias, and what she did was to spend 2 to 3 days in the media center where each student had access to a computer, and the students were to find all they could on utopias, do research on it, and then in teams create their own utopia and present their own utopia to the class as part of a multimedia project. Well, that was an enormous investment of that teacher's time. She had to find photos, load the computers with the photos. She had to find the sources and everything. And then the students found their own stuff. And all of this took, I would say, about 4 weeks. And they had an all-day Saturday exhibition in which at least 300 to 400 students and parents came to see these multimedia presentations. That's the integration that is so rare, but when it occurs, it's marvelous.
Mm. And this is Allison Pirro?
Yes.
Okay. And she is what you call an early adapter.
Early adopter, that's right.
Early adopter.
Yeah,
okay.
These are people that are pioneers in effect. They're willing, they say they see the innovation, in this case, personal computers, as being easily adapted to the way they want to teach, and that it also increases and accelerates the learning that they want their students to do. They see the connection much more quickly than lots of other teachers, for the sake of example. And so she was an early adopter, and she was a pioneer in her school, and she integrated it. Now, most teachers, when they use the computer, see it as an add-on, but she saw it as something that could be easily involved and become integral to what she wanted her students to learn.
Has the technology changed the way she teaches?
It has over time. Yes, it has. In her case, she is much more willing to give up certain kinds of authority to the kids, because the kids now, she becomes much more of a guide, a helper, a coach when she moves around, when you see her moving around the library when the kids are working at the computers, and they'll raise their hands and she comes over and she helps them, she questions them. She has much more individual contact, and she's not a person at the center of everything. Now, she will teach when she will have a whole group discussion from time to time. She will also give short lectures. But it has changed her teaching, and she'll be the first to say that. But it has been a period of time, at least 5 years, that this has occurred.
Yeah. I know someone who is doing this kind of teaching in Urbana, and it involves bringing in the students as part of the teaching experience. The kids are actually taking part in teaching responsibilities.
Right.
In terms of sometimes the teacher does not have all the answers because the technology is so huge. And the students can play a role in bringing everybody up to date.
That really happens. But again, I should point out that it's with a very small number of teachers. And there are reasons why that is. It's not because teachers are technophobes. It's not because teachers are some kind of closet Luddites or anything like that. Because a lot of these teachers will use computers at home for other things. So you have to look at the nature of the school as a workplace. You know, what's the teaching load that teachers have, particularly at secondary schools? What are the demands on teachers? All of those things have to be looked at in coming to a kind of conclusion about why teachers don't use the machines more at home than they do for instruction in school.
Yeah. Does Allison Pirro have the backing of her school, her building, her district? What's allowed her, besides her enthusiasm and her ability to adopt and adopt early, being open, really open to the technology? Are there other things in place for her that have allowed her to do the kind of teaching she's doing?
That's a good question. And in her case, you named a number of the factors. There was, she had access to increasing numbers of machines in the library. The school was supportive. They provided staff development in technology for those teachers who wanted it, and she took advantage of that. But what the school did that was most important is that she had a reduced teaching load of three classes instead of five classes. And the reason is that she was also working on another project, which is why they took away two of her assignments. But that reduced teaching load was, she would have been the first to tell you, as she told me, was a lifesaver for her, because she could then spend much more time planning for that Utopia unit and for other units to integrate the technology.
And then has she been given an opportunity, and have other teachers within her building been given the opportunity, her to teach those other teachers and the other teachers an opportunity to learn from her?
Well, that particular school, as described in the book, has a technology coordinator, a fine person, who was helping lots of teachers, and they had a lot of resources. So there was some kind of support system, some kind of infrastructure there. But when you realize that the teachers had to teach five classes a day, and their class size was 30 to 35 students in every class, and most of the teachers didn't start from the point that Alison Pirro started with her set of beliefs about what would be best for students. Many of the other teachers saw teaching much technology much more as an add-on rather than something that could be integrated. Mm-hmm. So when you add up all of these factors, then you see that there was only a small percentage of teachers who were serious users and occasional users.
Hmm, very interesting. We have a listener waiting to talk with us
Sure.
this afternoon. Let's talk with this caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm wondering whether the guest is familiar with the Novanet system.
Say that again?
The Novanet system?
I'm afraid I'm not.
Okay, this is a system that was developed at the University of Illinois here. It was privatized 6 or 7 years ago, and it has been extremely successful across the country. It's used primarily, I believe, in alternative settings. The system handles traditional subject matters, and I was very much tuned into what you said earlier about the credential being as important as the learning. With the type of teens, usually it's mostly high school, middle school and high school, these are people who have repeatedly been unsuccessful in the traditional classroom. And the Novanet system provides curricula and training for the teachers. It's in at least scores and probably hundreds of sites now. And if you're interested, I can give you a phone number where you could get more information.
This sounds like an online curriculum. Is that what it is?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and it's a form of distance learning then.
That's correct.
Yeah, and when they reach populations who are underserved or not being served fully, as the population that you described, I think that they meet a very important need. And right now, there is an effort to try to make online curriculum available for all, for all students, an online high school, for example, something like that. And while I would have questions about that, I usually don't have any questions about online curriculum targeted to particular students who are not being fully served, who volunteer to do that. Yeah. So, although I'm not familiar with that particular Illinois system, I know of systems here in California and New York.
Okay. The Novanet system is in some ways unique, and you might find it profitable to follow up on it in your research later.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Thanks
for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Our guest this afternoon, Larry Cuban, he's a professor emeritus at Stanford University and a visiting professor of education at Teachers College Columbia. He's the author of the book Oversold and Underused, Computers in the Classroom. And that is the topic of our conversation here this afternoon, Computers in the Classroom. Questions and comments are invited in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Distance learning, how widely is it being used in high schools, at the high school level today?
I don't have an answer for that. I know that there is a lot of talk about its use, and particularly for rural high schools where there aren't enough students to form an advanced French class or a calculus class or something like that, then rural school districts will try to locate an online curriculum course from a local university. But I don't have a sense of that. The fact that it was privatized, as the last caller suggested, tells you that the online curriculum is seen as an entrepreneurial opportunity for a number of potential vendors. But I don't have any statistics on that.
Well, we spent a little time talking about computers at the high school level and the success Allison Pirro has had. Let's move back to preschool and elementary school, the classrooms of Esperanza Rodriguez and Mark Hunter. Maybe you can give us some idea of what an integrated computer situation is at that level of education.
Right. In both of those classrooms, there were multiple computers. One was a preschool and one was a kindergarten. There were multiple computers, and each of those teachers literally smoothly moved from one lesson to another, and the computers were simply part of that lesson, either as a large group where the teacher would describe the piece of software and what each student had to do, and then made connections in the student's mind so when they went to the computer, they would easily they would see the linkages that the teacher had made. But what impressed me so much was that how at home the kids felt with the computers, and when I and my graduate students went from computer station to computer station, the kids were very voluble, were easily told us what they were doing, and when we asked questions, had the answers. It was very impressive. And again, it was the facility that the students had and how much they saw it as part of the natural environment of that classroom.
And these teachers, Esperanza Rodriguez and Mark Hunter, also, I suspect, early adopters?
Yes, they were. In both of their, in the preschool, there was a suite of preschools, four of them, and while they all had the same number of computers, it was Esperanza who was the regular user of those computers by integrating it into each of her lessons every morning. And at the elementary school for the kindergarten teacher, what he was doing in the kindergarten wasn't being done elsewhere in the school, and there was only one other kindergarten teacher in the entire district that was as eager as he was about having five-year-olds work on these computers at least an hour and a half every morning.
And the kids, it sounds like they were enthusiastic about this tool in the classroom.
Very much so. Most of the kids had computers at home, and the way that each of these teachers looked at it was that it was just part of the, it was seamless with all the activities they were doing. For example, they had different centers in each of these classrooms. They had a language arts center, a sandbox, a blocks. They had a play center, and then they had a computer center. And it was just natural for them to move through these centers more than once over the course of a morning. And then there were so many other computers that if the children wanted to use those computers, they had an optional time and they used it then. It was very smooth.
Let's talk with another listener.
Sure.
Also in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Good afternoon. I'm an old ex-teacher, I guess. I used to teach out on the Indian reservations in South Dakota. And Indian reservation schools are traditionally the poorest in the nation. And when I went out there, I thought I'd have to try something different. So I did everything exactly backwards. And it kind of works in with what you're talking about today. And I found out the less I taught, the higher the scores went. And it was all in the secret of managing the classroom. And I taught in a multi-level classroom, and it was very successful.
Larry Cuban, do you have any comment?
Well, he's what the gentleman is saying is that he learned one of those important lessons that all of us learn. Sometimes it takes us many years to learn. Is that you can teach very well by being subtle and not controlling and dominating a classroom. That's what I take from his comment.
Yes, I found that when I gave the students the responsibility for their education and never let them place it on me, that they excelled very well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your call this afternoon. Thank you for the comment. This brings me to a question, though, that tangential to what this gentleman was saying, and that is, are there parts of the country where we haven't seen resources allocated for computers, and there are kids that don't have the opportunity to use computers, and where computers have not been oversold, and they are undersold and, you know, not available? Where are we in terms of, you know, not only in places like in Indian country, but also in poorer school districts, whether they be rural or urban?
Well, that is certainly the case. What people have called the digital divide between, let's say, low-income schools with that enroll low-income minorities, let's say in Chicago or Detroit, Philadelphia, New York, and Los Angeles, there is a gap between the numbers of students per computer in these areas as opposed to the affluent suburbs that surround those cities. So that does exist, but that gap has been shrinking over the past 5 to 7 years. And at some point in the future, it will be roughly the same. That does not deal, that's, again, the access issue. That does not deal with the use issue, which I pointed out earlier is far more important, is that are the teachers using these machines and the software for teaching and learning in ways that help both the students and the teachers themselves? And that is a very different kind of question than whether or not there's a digital divide.
Hmm. Now, the children enrolled in schools that you studied in Santa Clara County in California, is there a pretty big difference in terms of socioeconomic background between school buildings and within the district or within the county? I don't know how it's set up there in California.
It was set up by both counties and school districts, and we purposely chose schools that had particularly the preschool and kindergarten classrooms and the high schools. We chose those that were culturally diverse and had a broad range of socioeconomic classes. And in those schools, we found that the ratio of students to computers was better than at the state level. In this case, we had somewhere between 5 to 7 students per computer, which in 1998, when we 1999, when we did the study, was a third higher, a third lower than the state average, and in this case, more than half lower than the national average. So the access was there. But again, the logic that I mentioned earlier about access leading to use didn't materialize.
Yeah, and how are those machines, how are those tools, if you will, being integrated into the curriculum? Are they useful or not?
That's the question?
No, I mean, that's the question.
That's correct.
That's the underlying question.
And you got the message of the book.
Yeah. And I think what you've said so far today, certainly if there are parents out there listening, they certainly should have a better idea of when they go into a classroom that is using computers, they can make a better judgment on how successful or unsuccessful that classroom is in terms of using the computer effectively and productively.
Now, I would hope so.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the university level.
Sure.
You quote our president, James Stuckel, in
yes.
the book as saying that the internet and the technology supporting it is the third modern revolution in higher education after the land grant movement and the upsurge in community colleges.
Right.
Do you agree with him?
No, I don't. it was a fine quote, and the president of the system at that time, is he still the president?
Yes, he is.
Is part of the that technological enthusiast cadre of higher ed administrators across the country that have jumped on to that particular bandwagon and claim that it's going to revolutionize teaching and learning in the university and so on. And what I found at Stanford is that that simply didn't occur, although the Stanford president was very high on it but didn't make the kind of statements that were as quotable as your president did.
Yeah.
So what I found at Stanford was that the which is you know, a highly selective institution. It has enormous access to the wiring. The whole campus is wired, has computer labs everywhere on campus, so there's not a problem of access. Well, what I found was that the students and the professors use computers all the time, and they had multiple computers at the office, at home, in the dormitory, laptops. They had computers coming out of their ears, the point being that for purposes of instruction, not for purposes of research or communication or preparation of materials, but for purposes of instruction, it was hardly used in the university.
Yeah, it's interesting to realize that the lecture still rules.
Yes. Well, because there are strong economic reasons why the lecture is an important part of the instructional repertoire of universities. It's just because you have a tool that supposedly can transform lectures into other kinds of learning activities doesn't mean it's going to be used.
Should it be used?
Well, I think it depends, as I pointed out at the in K to 12 schools. If the teachers can find ways to integrate the technology to improve teaching and learning in ways that they had not foreseen before, then it ought to be used. And I give examples of some professors who did that.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we're going to go to Peoria on line 4, the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hi. Hi. I've got a simple question and a complex question. My simple question is, how young can children effectively keyboard? And my more complex question is perhaps almost more of a comment. It's interesting, at the start of World War II, the French Army actually had significantly more tanks than the German Army, but they distributed them among their infantry formations, and they were basically used just to back up infantrymen. The Germans, of course, had the Blitzkrieg, and the rest is history. And I'm wondering, how do we use technology, not just computers, but also videotape and things like that, in ways that are new, that are something other than just support for the lecture? And I will hang up and listen.
Okay, I hope I can remember those questions. The simple question was which one?
How young, I mean...
That's right, yeah, to use a keyboard.
To use a keyboard.
Right, well, you know, kids vary so much. So there are kids who can tap things out on the keyboard 18 months, 2 years old, and so on. And there are kids, and there is software now that is aimed at kids who are a year old or less. But that avoids the question about should they be on a keyboard? Should they be watching that screen for short periods of time or long periods of time? And no one really knows. Now, there is a psychologist by the name of Jane Healy who wrote a book, Failure to Connect, How Computers Affect Our Children's Minds, for Better or Worse, a few years ago. And she makes the point that in school, there is no sense in making a big deal for kids under the age of 7. She's really aimed at preschoolers and primary school children at that age, who at best might use it infrequently, and that would be fine from her point of view. The way that I saw it used in preschool and kindergarten, it was fairly benign, and it was a small chunk of time, 15 minutes, a half an hour in most of those settings, and that did not seem to be intrusive. or too much. I do worry about, I got calls from parents when word of our study got out. The parents who had 2 and 3-year-olds wanted to show me how much their children can do on the computer, and I told them I wasn't interested in that. That was not the direction of the study. But there are some parents who make the connection that if a kid can work on a computer at that very young age, they're set for Harvard. And I tried to disabuse them of that, but I found that I failed.
Yeah, so much pressure on kids, on some kids, to learn all kinds of skills way before school.
Right. Now, the second question is about the disposition of the technology. And the gentleman was using the comparison between the French and the German military and how technology can be used as a resource to help the lecture, or it can be used to replace the lecture. And both of those kinds of strategies are being used right now in higher education. One is to make the lecture more informative, and you have more graphics used, you have the VCR, you have overheads, you have the use of the computer with PowerPoint presentations, which in effect enhance the lecture. And then there are online curriculum courses that replace the lecture, not with talking heads, but with other activities where it's done individually with each student logging on. So there is a great deal of variation about the uses of the technology.
Yeah. At the higher education level, good things that I've heard about the computer in the classroom and outside the classroom is that you can have online discussions outside of the classroom. You can communicate. You have more opportunity for communication with professors if they are so inclined. You can do remedial work, and you can do a lot of independent study as well. Those are just a few things that come to mind that are great opportunities for students in university. Let's talk with another listener before we run out of time here on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'm a retired math teacher from the Champaign School District, and I would just like to convey my enthusiasm for the use of technology and how we did it in our local high school. First of all, I think that the professor is right in that it does take a lot of professional development and a lot of work on teachers' parts. But if teachers get enthused about it, it can have fabulous results. What we did in our mathematics department was to work together as a department to go to professional meetings and find the exciting applications that one could put computers to and lobby the district for those software programs that would help us to implement that. We completely rewrote our curriculum to integrate the use of technology and the applications right into the teaching of mathematics. And it's just had dramatic results in our department. We fight for the computer lab on a daily basis because there are so many teachers that want to get in there. And just as an example, in an algebra class that I was teaching, we were doing some work with exponential functions, and then we used the computer as a way for the students to go and look at how cars depreciate over time, and they picked the cars that they were most interested in and did a report where they had to do graphs and then actually come up with the exponential function that showed the depreciation. So I guess I'm just really pro the use in the right way. As he says, it has to be integrated in the correct way.
Well, it's I would urge this retired teacher to unretire and help other teachers, because what she described are two conditions. The teachers work together before the technology even arrived, and the teachers decided how they were going to use the technology and collaborated. That kind of collaboration is rich and unusual, unfortunately. And so they had had the preconditions for the use of technology, and they did it very nicely, as she described.
Mm. I want to thank her for her call this afternoon, and I hope she's happy in her retirement. Larry, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. I'm sorry to say we're out of time.
Well, thank you very much, Celeste.
Larry Cuban has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of the new book, Oversold and Underused Computers in the Classroom. It's very readable. It's published by Harvard University Press. Larry Cuban is a professor emeritus at Stanford University and a visiting professor of education at Teachers College, Columbia.